Hi, I'm Mickey Lowe.
Hi, I'm Bishop Todd.
And welcome to the C4SO podcast. Well, welcome back to the C4SO podcast, everyone. Bishop Todd, it's great to be back with you.
Hey, good to see you too. You feeling up for a podcast today? You ready to go?
Yes, we are ready to go.
All right.
We're in a good weekly rhythm.
Yeah.
We get to talk to so many amazing people. We've got a great lineup. So we are really looking forward to sharing today's conversation with our friend, Jonathan Abraham Kinberg. He is the mobilizer for Diaspora Network in our diocese.
Yeah, when I first met Jonathan and began talking with him about being in C4SO, I could just tell Mickey there was something really special about him. And what I mean is he literally is somebody in the last few years who I've met who has a really obvious, strong, like anointing from God is the way I would put it. Like a gifting to work with diaspora people. He is remarkable. I have so much respect when I watch him in action with people from all over the world. I'm just blown away at his ease, like whatever it is, he's got some sort of spiritual magic.
Totally. And he's super knowledgeable as well. So he's a huge resource and a gift to our diocese. And we just get to have a really rich conversation with him about what it means to be, you know, people of diaspora, what it means to minister to those from other countries and how we can, you know, utilize their gifts in our own churches and just a super rich conversation that I'm excited to share. And as a reminder to our listeners, we have the Diaspora Conference coming up at the end of July. So that's not something you want to miss. So if you're interested
in Austin, Texas, I'll be there.
Yep. In Austin, Texas, we'll both be there. So definitely don't want to miss that. Without further ado, please enjoy this conversation with our friend, Jonathan. Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. We're so excited to have you on the show today.
Great to be on, Mickey. Thank you.
Yes. So let's get to know you a little bit. So we are going to get into a little bit of your background, maybe a little bit later down the interview. But for now, we would just love to hear about your upbringing in the sense of if you can think of one memory from growing up. So you spent a large portion of your childhood in South America. So you were born in Peru, lived in Chile and in Panama, as well as the States. So give us maybe a short, like, treasured memory or experience during your time spent there. And it could be in any of those places.
I mean, it's definitely a bittersweet memory, but it maybe encapsulates a little bit of my background. I remember going to first grade, the first day of first grade in Chile. I didn't speak any Spanish, and it was an all Spanish speaking Chilean school. And I was just crying as my dad was dropping me off. And I cried for 2 weeks straight. I would come home.
What's the sweet part of that? That sounds all bitter.
I'm getting there. Okay. You know, I'd run home at the end of the day because I didn't know how to ask even how to go to the bathroom. I'd run because I'd been holding all day. But about after those 2 weeks, that's the bitter part. The sweet part is, as a first grader, you just pick up a language so quickly. And so, you know, after those 2 weeks, I started getting comfortable. And within probably 6 months, I spoke Spanish. And that has served me the rest of my life and is a key part of my story. And
wow, who I am. Good for you.
Yeah.
So if you think about coming to the U.S., we like to ask our friends this question. So think about your, you know, when you came back to the U.S., think of something that you had to learn that like you're secretly now really good at and something you had to learn that you still stink at.
Well, I mean, there was back and forth my whole life. And so, but one of the big returns was in middle school, and we moved to Kentucky for 2 years where my mom's family's from. I didn't know how to dress in Chile. Oh. Like, you wear a uniform to school every day.
Right.
You don't have to think about what to wear. I didn't know American fashion. I didn't know American pop culture. I still don't in many ways. So I'd never even worn like blue jeans before. And so I hope I'm a little better at least at fashion now. I don't know if I'm much better.
Oh, that's great.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's good. Well, we're so glad that God has brought you, Jonathan, to C4SO and yes. the difference you're making and leading us and thinking about global issues, especially with regard to migration and immigration and diaspora and how the nations are shifting around and in many cases coming to America, not just to America, but we happen to be Americans. And so we're trying to deal with how people are coming to America. So what was it about C4SO's vision and values that made you think that we might be a good home for your work?
Yeah, I think mission and spirit, honestly, you know, those two of the five, I think, key values. So much of my work and so much of my life has been kind of crossing boundaries, borders, cultures, which involves both mission and spirit. I mean, that's the spirit's work of sending the church and of empowering the church to cross those borders, boundaries, and live in new spaces and places that were not part of the story before. And so I think that sort of missional flexibility is key to working among and with and learning from diaspora. It's also at the heart of the Holy Spirit's work from Pentecost on, and both bringing that gathering of the nations as well as sending to and of the nations.
So let's go back a little bit in your story, Jonathan. Your parents were missionaries. You kind of have traveled back and forth. Tell us more about just your experience kind of between these countries, between like Latin America and the intersection of this work with migration and immigration. And then, tell us more about your upbringing. And then how did that shape kind of your sense of calling to ministry, and really when and how the notion of diaspora came to your attention?
Yeah, really, you know, movement, migration has been part of my family story and really kind of DNA in my family for generations. So I usually start talking about my last name, Kinberg, comes from my great grandfather on my dad's side. He and my great grandmother, they were Dutch Swedish immigrants, most likely came through Ellis Island. I've been trying to do a little bit more research on that, and then settled in the New Jersey area. And so, like most folks, except for indigenous folks in the United States, my family is an immigrant family. And so that migration from Europe to the U.S. on my dad's side was there. But then my great-grandparents' son, my grandfather, my dad's dad, him and my grandmother, they went to Wheaton College. They were in the same class with Jim and Elizabeth Elliott, and of that generation that was kind of this global sending. And so, you know, a generation before they'd come to the U.S. from Europe, and then they're sent to Latin America, to the jungles of Peru, very similar story to Jim and Elizabeth Elliott's in the jungles of Ecuador, and served an unreached people group for, I think it was 25 plus years. And so there's already movement there. And then my dad was born in Peru. Then my sister and I were born in Peru. And so this is just, it's just part of our family story. And then now my, I'm in the process of changing our names, but my middle name is changing to Abraham after being married, which is my wife's family name. And her family immigrated from India in the 70s. She was born and raised in Houston. And so we want to keep that part of our family's legacy as well. And so that's kind of a family that I'm being engrafted into, which is a large Indian immigrant family in the Dallas and Houston area.
So now let's hear about, you know, you sensing your own call to ministry in reference to diaspora and kind of the challenges that come with it. Tell us more about your story and how God called you into this work, how the Spirit called you into this work.
Yeah, so growing up in different countries, I was usually far away from my biological family, my blood family. I had one sister and my parents, but because of that, I was far from cousins, grandparents, and so the church was always our family where we were.
That's powerful. And
we went to an international bilingual church in Panama City, Panama, called Crossroads Bible Church that was really made up of the nations, Colombians and Venezuelans and Panamanians and business people from around the world. It was in English and Spanish. And that church during high school for me really became my family. I was mentored there. I had opportunities for leadership. And I remember one of the things the church would repeat, which I think they probably got from Willow Creek, was the church is the hope of the world. And I experienced belonging, family, welcome, and could see how the church was family for those who didn't have family and was really hope.
Yeah.
And so that, I think, planted a seed. I said, I want to be a part of that, giving belonging and identity, that hope bringing to the world. And I don't know exactly what that would look like, but I would say from high school on, I had this sense that somehow I wanted to bless and encourage and be a part of the church as part of my vocation as well.
Amen.
So Jonathan, for our listeners today who, you know, maybe aren't expert on history and issues of migration and immigration, give us some context and background and history. What's like, if you just think of somebody who's really a beginner in this conversation, what's going on with migration and immigration? What's underneath it?
Yeah, that's a huge question, and a complex one in the United States with a lot of history behind it. Let me see if I can kind of pull some threads maybe out from that tapestry. First of all, this goes to, you know, the founding of the United States as a country. We have been, from the inception, an immigrant nation and an immigrant church, therefore, from our founding.
So if you think of America when there were only original peoples, from that moment on, we literally have been an immigrant country. That's what you're saying, right?
Correct. Yeah. You know, whether it was Spaniards or English pilgrims that, you know, you might call refugees to some degree, fleeing Europe. You know, there have been essentially different waves of immigration, and usually centered on different parts of the world. We had that long period of European primary immigration. And so then, therefore, the church was a primarily European immigrant church from the beginning. And so Anglican, of course, from England. I mean, the Anglican church is an immigrant church from its inception, a migrant church in the United States. But you go back to other denominations, like, say, the Covenant. It was a Swedish Covenant church. So Swedish immigrants. A story that my friend Matt Sorens likes to tell. He's the author of the book Welcoming the Stranger and lives in a community in Aurora, Illinois, with his family. He tells a story of the church they go to, which is a Spanish-speaking Lutheran church, but was before a German-speaking Lutheran church. And then became kind of slowly as German migration sort of ebbed and flowed and ebbed, really, and the children of those immigrants began speaking English. That church began dying. But then there was a revitalization as they had a Spanish language service, and that grew. And so that is just kind of a picture of really just name the denomination that if it was founded, all denominations in the U.S. are going to be inherently immigrant. There are no indigenous, Sam George says, there's no indigenous Christianity to the United, to this continent.
So let's go back a little bit. I think what I'm wanting our listeners to get a little handle on, Jonathan, is just simply this. Like, is a big part of the migration that's happening these days, is it economic? Is it, you know, fleeing a political issue, civil unrest? And I guess at the end of the day, does it matter how someone ends up on our shores? Or do you see what I'm getting at? Like, what's driving this?
Yeah, it's very complex, and there's a number of factors and forces.
Well, just give us a couple of headlines. I just want people to imagine what's kind of driving these people.
So, I think I can paint like a real specific picture of the context that I'm familiar with, but is pretty common across the country. So Austin is where I've lived for the last year and a half. And the top five immigrant groups in Austin are Mexican, Indian, Chinese, Vietnamese and Honduran. Okay. Mm-hmm. So each of those five groups have a very different story of how they arrived in Austin.
Yeah. Right. And so, what drives them.
And what brought them. Yeah. Yeah. So Mexican, that's a that's an older immigrant group in Austin. That's going to be right now. There are very few historically compared to the last 30 years, very few Mexicans coming to the United States. Most of those folks are from 20, 30 years. It's an older group there. And that was largely economic. And a lot of those folks helped build Texas and the city of Austin.
Right.
Now you go to, say, Chinese and Indian.
Yes.
That's largely economic, business, and education. Okay. So a lot of Chinese international students in Austin and across the country. That's actually upholding a lot of our universities because they pay full tuition.
Yeah.
International students have to pay full tuition. And
right.
that hurt a lot of universities during COVID. A lot of Indian students, as well as folks in the tech sector. And as Austin is growing tech sector, a lot of business folks, that's my wife's family. There's also many, many doctors and nurses. And so that's a professional, largely immigrant group. Vietnam, that's tied to the war in Vietnam. That's an older group as well. And a lot of folks coming after the war in Vietnam. And then Honduras is the most recent group. And you see that at the U.S. border right now. A lot of Central Americans coming because of economic and political instability. So hopefully that paints a little bit of a picture.
No, that's really helpful. Yeah, I just wanted people to have that imagination. So then when it gets right down to ministering to these groups of people, Jonathan, as you do, is the accent on what drove them here, or is the accent on simply being present to who you're with and discerning needs and how to serve and that sort of thing?
So I'm not going to answer your question directly. I think part of what the accent that I have felt convicted of highlighting in the last couple of years is that the majority of immigrants that are coming are Christian. And almost a flip of, for a long time, there was a very much a focus on welcoming the stranger. And that was sort of the primary framing within, say, primarily white Christian spaces,
right?
Which is very biblical, of course. There's like almost a step beyond that now. If we realize that the majority of Christians are coming are the majority of immigrants that are coming to the U.S. are Christian, and they're actually revitalizing the church in the U.S. There's almost this accent of how do we receive the gifts, the tremendous missional impulse that folks are bringing.
That's
and
really
so
helpful.
Particularly for white Americans, who I'm assuming is probably the majority of our audience, how do we receive the fervor, the thriving global Christianity that they bring? I mean, I don't know, Bishop Todd, if you might be able to share from even your experience at the conference last year, Diaspora Conference, and remember some of your feedback afterwards about your faith being renewed by just being there for a day. Or
I remember just feeling like really unusual levels of love for God and love for each other. I mean, it's really just that simple. There was a warmth, an acceptance, a hospitality, all completely unfeigned. You could just tell coming from their heart. And yes, I felt something really different. I'm not so much criticizing other spaces that I live and work in. It's that that one seemed unusually positive in the ways I described. So you're right. It makes your point that a lot of these migrants are coming with deep faith and they're filled with the Spirit of God and they have gifts to bring, et cetera. Yeah.
There's a story that I picked up from a friend of a friend that I share often, maybe as a picture of this, is this is maybe 5 or 6 years, and there was this large migrant caravan from Central America that came to the border. It was all over the news, and there's a lot of hype and fear surrounding that. And there were many folks that went down to kind of serve, and you know, there was just a need for basic human necessities like shelter and food. And this friend of a friend was part of this church group that crossed the border and just helped at the shelter. I think they brought some food, and but then I think there was some kind of gospel sharing and maybe some worship singing. But at the end, one of the migrants from Central America came up and said, "Are you going to take an offering?" And my friend's friend said, well, no, this is not, we're not, you know, we're coming here to serve, like, just, there's no monetary expectation. Mm-hmm. And the friend said, no, like, I would like to bring an offering. And this migrant, and so the leader said, well, okay. And I don't remember the quantity. It might have been, I think, like $20 or something. But the migrant said, I want to give an offering of thanksgiving that God brought me here safely.
Wow.
And there was this tremendous generosity, this picture of sort of the widow's mite almost,
yes,
of somebody who had left their family. They'd suffered. They'd crossed, you know, borders, you know, and they're coming with this vibrant faith and generosity. And this is something I've experienced over and over of this. We often come to serve and we need to, you know, particularly with folks that have relief needs, come and welcome the stranger. But what if the stranger has more to give than we have to, we need to receive their gifts that they come to bring.
Yeah.
That's so good. That really gets into something that we wanted to talk about with you, is what the gospel imperative is here and what is the opportunity. And I think, you know, for Western Christians, that there is so much to learn from Christians in other parts of the world and vice versa. And especially the beautiful thing about being in the Anglican Communion is that we're worldwide, right? So it is just really wise to welcome the gifts of others and to make space in our churches for those gifts. But can you think of any other, you know, gospel opportunities there are for us and the opportunity to come alongside what the Spirit is doing and bringing people to where we're at?
Yeah, I think you highlight, Mickey, this growing theme as we recognize that the majority of the church is outside the United States, in Europe, in the global South.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us have sought ways of learning and receiving from the global church. But what if the global church is coming to our neighborhoods?
Mm-hmm.
What if those gifts are right here in our midst? And so what does it look like to then come together? I think there's kind of an Ephesians moment in the sense of the Jew-Gentile unity of the church, where there's, and I see it over and over, there's kind of these parallel tracks of the church, and not just to in the U.S., where often the immigrant church, and not just that, but other marginalized communities, named the African-American church or other segments of the church in the U.S. as well, but that mm-hmm. often operate separate and distinct and also very differently resourced. And how do we actually build deep partnerships and learn together so that the body would be complete, as it is talked about in Ephesians, that Ephesians 4, that unity of the body actually leads to its maturity and growth on mission. And so that we actually need each other, but we don't know each other. For my sake, I didn't know the Indian immigrant church until really getting to know my wife's family. But that this is actually in all of our cities across the U.S. and a thriving presence. And so how do we build these bridges of partnership together?
Yeah.
So before we shift gears here, Jonathan, I'm just thinking of, you know, people in our churches and clergy in our churches listening to this podcast and maybe wondering, is there a both and? Is there a tension between working on public policy versus working on just like what's happening in your city? Like I think of what's happening now on the Mexican-California border and our churches in Southern California working on that. I'm thinking of, like, you know, Kendi's ideas on anti-racism, that they have to turn to public policy that creates good, or it's not really anti-racism. No, so I'm not trying to argue for or against Kendi, but just to put that out there as a way of thinking about this. So how would you encourage or counsel our churches who are just dipping their toes in this water to think about that simultaneity, maybe between public policy versus, like, this is right in our backyard?
Yeah, I think justice is a very local work, and mm-hmm. it does have larger ramifications, and Christians should definitely be concerned about federal policy. And I'm a large advocate of comprehensive immigration reform, and groups like the Evangelical Immigration Table that bring Christians together around comprehensive change to public policy and federal policy particularly. But that honestly won't make most sense to most listeners until you have a direct relationship with a human being that this affects. We can't really have a positive voice for change around justice until it's become very local and very personal. And often it's easier to kind of sign a petition or with these big kind of national things, but it doesn't change our day-to-day life in our local place.
Right.
And so I think for me, for example, when I pastored an immigrant church in Chicago that was made up of maybe about half were undocumented, mostly Mexican folks, what was public policy became actually more than just a justice issue, became a pastoral issue. This wasn't something out there. These were the folks that were afraid to drive to church.
Real people. Yeah.
Yeah. Like when I started my service, it was a 6 p.m. Saturday service. And I had folks say, "Hey, pastor, could we move the service a little earlier on Saturdays?" And I said, "Well, sure. Why?" And they said, "We're afraid to drive home after dark because we could get pulled over." This was before a change in policy in Illinois that gave undocumented folks licenses. So many of my folks in my church didn't have a driver's license. They were afraid to drive at night because they could get pulled over and end up in jail and then be deported. And I had parishioners that were. And so that, you know, encouraged me to understand, people don't have a form of ID that's accepted. That's actually a very local Illinois issue. And so a lot of Christians and pastors advocated for IDs. And now you can get driver's, it's not a license, it's called a driver's permit in Illinois. And so now my former parishioners are more comfortable driving to church after dark. But that was so specific. I had no idea until I was in a real relationship. And that led me then to advocate for policy changes because it was the people in the pews, literally.
Hey, I'm from Mifflin. Kwoka is my name.
Saludos. My name is Jonathan Kinberg. And we want to together invite you to our second annual Diaspora Network Conference. Our theme this year is mutuality and mission. What does it look like for immigrants and the broader North American church to really partner together?
The conference will be on July 28th and 29th in Austin, Texas, and it's for immigrants and leaders from C4SO who want to partner with the nations here. See you soon.
So, Jonathan, let's talk more now about the Diaspora Network with our diocese. Tell us some about the work that you currently do, and it can just be kind of broad, give a description, and then how you envision C4SO churches partnering with the Diaspora Network.
For sure. And I'd love to hear some of your story too, Mickey, at some point,
totally.
If your family's story, if you're up for
sharing
some of that as it connects to diaspora.
Yeah.
And as you'll be leading worship at the conference.
Yes, I'm very excited.
And you led us in bilingual worship at the clergy conference.
Yeah, let me just say that I've been really blessed by the Diaspora Network. I, as a first-generation immigrant, I have felt so supported by our diocese and really empowered. And I love the work that you do, Jonathan, and I love the people that you've gathered together. They've just been a huge blessing to me. And there's always something to learn, and it's a real beautiful communal space. So firsthand, I can just give a testimony that it's just been a wonderful work that's been going on. So I'm really proud of the Diaspora Network. So I wanted to give you a chance to kind of tell our listeners, if they're not familiar, what it is that we do.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you've been a blessing, and I'm sure will be a blessing this summer too. Yeah, so the Diaspora Network seeks to kind of first bring together and encourage immigrant leaders who are already in our diocese, such as yourself, Mickey, and create a space that's often language specific. You know, there's something about being with other people and just talking in Spanish that if that's your mother tongue or one of your languages, it just brings you alive in a way that doesn't happen otherwise. And so similarly, you know, culture and language and nationality, ethnicity, as well as race, are these markers of deep belonging. And so how do we create in our diocese places and spaces of deep belonging for immigrants? And so when I'm new to the diocese, it's been about 2 years now. When I joined, I would say, well, who are the immigrants already in our diocese? How do we come around and encourage them?
Yeah.
And there's some sprinkled in congregations that we have, but then there's also immigrant-specific churches and a Latino church Mission de San Lucas in Kansas City, and mm-hmm. Nigerian Church, Igbo Anglican in California. And so when we first started, it was just, how do we listen to them? How do we encourage and equip them? And that's part of our conference, is wanting to just provide some specific resources and spaces. But then more broadly, you're saying that's just a very small pocket of what God's doing through the immigrant church in the U.S. So how do we help C4SO learn, receive from, kind of jump on this moving train of this amazing move of God? And so we want to partner and learn from other denominations and churches, as well as hopefully plant immigrant churches. So our conference this year, this is our second annual, is a space where we want to bring together immigrant as well as non-immigrant, kind of the broader church. How do we partner? How do we learn from each other? How do we work together? And so there's kind of this dance of creating unique spaces. We have prayer in Spanish on Zoom every week. We have a Nigerian prayer space on Zoom each week. We have those at our conference, but then also spaces where we can really partner, work together, and then hopefully work new ministries and initiatives as well.
Yeah. So you mentioned a little while ago that, you know, the things that we hear, the policies, you know, these are in regards to real people in the pews. So we'd love for you to just tell us a couple of stories of the C4SO leaders who are effectively involved with Diaspora Network right now. So you can talk about Jose Carmen Zurita, you know, yeah. La Familia Ortiz, or Will in California, or Reverend Afam. Tell us more about maybe just short stories about these real people who are doing this real work right now.
Yeah, these are the real heroes of the church, and folks that have just on a daily basis encourage and strengthen my faith. I think of Jose and Carmen Zurita, that many of the folks in the diocese began to get to know at the clergy conference a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago. They are stepping in to serve at Mission San Lucas in Kansas City now after Father Gene's passing. Mm-hmm. And they are just amazing missionaries. So they are in their 60s. They have grandkids. They've lived in the Dallas area for 40 years and are leaving family, kids, grandkids, their home to move to Kansas to serve a small, but we pray growing immigrant community there. And just a sacrificial commitment to the gospel. And they travel regularly to Mexico, to Colombia, and are just on the move as a couple, and have been for a long time, and just often quietly behind the scenes with not an official mission organization. They're not on, you know, websites and podcasts, but they are doing the real work and have stories of miracles and of conversions. And they had a 6-hour Bible study a couple weeks ago they were telling me about. And at the end, someone became a Christian, and so they wanted to follow Jesus. And food somehow emerged, and there was dinner. And, you know, it's like,
that's amazing.
Sometimes we struggle to get folks to, you know, an hour Bible study and even just, you know, show up. And there, folks are saying, hey, we want more. We want more.
Yeah.
You know? I think of, Reverend Afam, who's moved from New Mexico after moving from Nigeria. He's here far from his wife and kids, and is sacrificially serving as well in the Bay Area and giving his life for the gospel. This is, you know, the suffering is so much a part of the immigrant story. Whether you come with privilege or whether you're fleeing as a refugee violence or whatever brought you here, suffering is inevitably a part of not belonging and of adapting and of leaving. And there's this purifying effect that suffering has in combination with the gospel that really revitalizes and keeps faith as a necessity, as opposed to perhaps an add-on or an optional thing. And so, there's so many stories I could share of parishioners who just practice sacrificial generosity. They're not on paid staffs. They're not, but are giving their lives for God and neighbor.
That's so true. And from my own experience coming to the States when I was 4 years old, my parents were missionaries, ministers with the Hispanic Assemblies of God. So it is really costly to follow Jesus, especially when God is calling you to a different country, different community, different, just everything completely different. And so I'm really grateful for my parents and their faithfulness to the Lord and to the service of God's people. But they really taught me, and I got to see this firsthand because I was a four-year-old with them, but just the costly sacrifice to have to relearn everything, to just be a stranger in this completely foreign setting, figure out what God is calling us to do, but also kind of how to gather our bearings. And so it is a very lived out faith of these immigrant Christians. And I'm really, really grateful for my parents and how they lived this out. And I got to see it. And so then when I, you know, my husband and I talked to our families and said, hey, we feel called to plant a church. My parents were like, you got this. It's going to be great. And
it's whatever part of your family's DNA.
It's part of the DNA. So it's really no surprise. And Bishop Todd, you were here for this, but when we had our consecration earlier in January, I overheard someone say to my mom, I overheard this and said, can you believe like what God is doing here? And my mom said, not to me, she didn't know I was listening, but she said, it's so crazy to think that God called us to this country many years ago.
Wow.
And God was not just calling us, he was calling her.
Wow.
And that's it is amazing to see how the Lord is working in Tampa and Ybor and how we answered God's call for us. But really, it was also our daughter, you know, living into this calling too. So I am so grateful for that. Mm-hmm. And I'm proud of my parents and I'm grateful for them. And yeah, the immigrant Christians have just beautiful testimonies, costly surrender, costly faith, but it changes things. It is just, it is awesome. So I, like I said, I firsthand experienced the greatness of diaspora and just the network of people that you're putting together, Jonathan. So I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah. And I think that's an amazing picture of how maybe unbeknownst to us off the radar, immigration has already blessed C4SO. You know, these movements, many of our leaders in the diocese are second generation. Their parents were immigrants.
Yeah.
And many of our folks don't know, you know, it's maybe just don't know to ask or isn't part of the story necessarily, but it has already shaped who C4SO is. You know, with your story from your parents coming from Argentina, you know, my family and many families, you know, for many years went as missionaries to South America. You know, we have a history in the U.S. of mission to places like Nigeria and so forth. The gospel was already there before we went. But now Argentina and Nigeria and these places are sending missionaries, whether formally or informally, as migrants to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And there's this amazing opportunity to now work together as the body of Christ.
So, Jonathan, just before we get to some practical things that Mickey has for you, listening to you guys talk reminds me that, you know, for many, many white people today who are, you know, thinking about these things, it's become pretty clear to see that virtually all the ways we learn to do theology or read the Bible or do spiritual formation or any of these things, we're essentially European-centric. Well, you don't have to be mad at anybody. I'm not mad at anybody. I'm not putting anybody down. Like, you don't have to be angry to say that. It's just like obvious. And it's not so much a put down of what was as it is, it feels like many of us are having this aha moment of what you two are saying, that we don't have to say that was all wrong or bad. We just need to say it was partial and that the kingdom is way bigger than North America and way bigger than Europe or Australia, New Zealand, the Western world, whatever, the developed world. To me, you guys have just illustrated this really important point that like God is working in all sorts of people and we all have things to teach each other and there's nothing to be afraid of here.
Yeah. And I think it's these categories even now of like by geography, the Western world or our migration breaks all those down.
Yeah.
So the, you know, quickly in many of our cities, the majority now of Christianity in the U.S. or the West is actually from the global church.
Right.
And so it's not only impartial, it's, I mean, quickly, for example, if we were to just stick with Western theology, we're not just omitting a lot of the thinking from over there, we're actually missing out on the majority of the church here. And so one of the quotes that is often repeated is, for example, in England, in the UK, is that they prayed for a revival, or we prayed for revival, but then we didn't recognize it because it was Black and primarily African. And, you know, many of the largest churches And most thriving churches in Europe now are led by Nigerians, for example. Right. The largest church in Europe before the war in Ukraine was led by a Nigerian, and it was a very Nigerian denomination, but a very multi-ethnic church of many Ukrainians meeting Jesus, mm-hmm. and they were doubly yeah. displaced now after the war. And so in the same way, you know, if you're in Ukraine, you could talk about global theology and study Nigerians, but Nigerian writing or something, but this is actually in you know what I mean? Like these what is Western yeah. now has, you know, it's like these boundaries and categories begin to be somewhat lack meaning in terms of the reality that we see in the US or in our cities.
Yeah. So I think I want to just stay here a moment longer because I know so many people are confused about this or they're afraid of it. It feels like we're trying to deconstruct or throw out, you know, huge parts of human history or something. And I don't feel like anything like that's happening. I guess maybe I'll just speak for myself. I don't feel like I have to throw out the stories that I read about the Eliots and what I learned from them. What I feel like I must do, though, is learn from your parents. They have a different story to tell that augments and makes more full and helps me understand things that I may not have heard from reading, you know, one sort of story. And for those of us who are in C4SO who read even just Esau Macaulay's book, Reading While Black, you understand how the Black church has a lot to teach us about suffering and right. about patience. And, you know, we tend to whine about, oh, I don't feel very close to God today. Well, how do Black people in the era of chattel slavery hang on to faith in God at all? Well, I don't know. I mean, I can learn from that and have learned from it and am learning from it. And I think that's, I just want to try to settle people that's all, and I don't know that this is all that's being said, but certainly the core of what's being said is that God is and has always been moving through people of color and in places all over the world. And that, and really, Jonathan, in some ways, you and Mickey and Esau and my other friends of color taught me this, that as these non-white, non-Europeans come to America and begin to move all over the world, that godness that's always been in them, that presence of God with the gift of the Spirit, it has something to give to us. And that shouldn't be something that scares us, in my view.
Yeah, I think it's, there's a TED Talk called The Danger of a Single Story, which kind of is maybe a way to summarize some of what you're saying, Bishop Todd, yeah. is it's not that the Western story that many of us hold is to be thrown out, but it's not, we have to begin to realize it's not the only story and it's not normative. And so for so long, for example, in mission and in the church and Christianity and theology, there has been a single story that others have had to adapt to and learn from and receive from. And I can speak because I kind of inhabit multiple worlds, you know, it's for many folks like myself to then say, this isn't the only story and it's actually not the normative story. Mm-hmm. It is a important story within Christianity and the church, whether you're talking about mission or theology. But
right.
now, what does it look like to actually hear and learn from, actually submit our stories to the broader story of God, that we're actually, it's not to replace, but it's actually to become more complete. We yeah. actually mm-hmm. learn who God is in a deeper way by hearing the stories of Mickey's parents and their sacrificial commitment to the gospel. And, you know, Jesus in Spanish isn't, Jesus doesn't replace, say, the white American context from which I come from and my understanding of Jesus, but I need to learn from Jesus mm-hmm. sure. yeah. so that the full picture of who Jesus is actually yeah. made more complete, and it frees mm-hmm. me from that idolatry of just the white Jesus, you know, or, yeah. or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of putting it, Jonathan, that none of us need to throw out our story or someone else's story. We all need to bring ourselves and our stories, as you say, before God and his kingdom, and then just repent, realign, fix, you know, just that process that we're all in. All of us who are coming out of a story individually and as our communities are coming out of a story, you're right. I think the most redemptive, non-scary way to think about this is we're just trying to follow Jesus and submit mm-hmm. to him and his kingdom. And it's just part of the Christian work.
I think it's the Jew-Gentile dynamic within yeah. the New Testament yeah. is there was a threat to the Jews by Gentiles becoming Christian. It meant Christianity looked different, sounded different. It was practiced in a different way. This is the first conflict in Acts, is a linguistic, ethnic conflict about the distribution of food. The Greek-speaking and the Jewish-speaking Jews, they're both Jews, but they're different ethnic and linguistic groups. And that's the challenge throughout the New Testament, but that actually brings up, it's the mystery of God, as it talks about in Ephesians 4 of the gospel, is revealed in a fuller way through the coming together of Jew and Gentile. So we actually desperately need this, I think mutuality is a word we use a lot, in the sense of this this real coming together of the church that could, if there's going to be a perceived threat that might say my story, then it needs to be somehow nullified or rejected. No, it's actually, how do we reconcile these stories in the gospel?
So Jonathan, we'd love to give people kind of a way to connect with you. I know we do weekly bilingual prayer calls. We do, is it quarterly, the Saturday meetings? We do prayer and fasting.
Yeah, about once a quarter, we've done a day of prayer and fasting.
Yeah, which are, I think, are really important. And then, of course, the conference in July. How can folks listening hear more or get connected with you and the things that we do within the network?
Yeah, a part of my learning has been that these kind of parallel worlds of Christians exist also in the technological space. And so many, many immigrants live in WhatsApp. And
yes, and WhatsApp is huge.
You know, it depends if you're from other parts of the world, there's different apps that are used.
Yes.
But WhatsApp encompasses a lot. Exactly. A lot of Nigerians and a lot of Latin Americans live on WhatsApp. So we've created some WhatsApp spaces. You know, that's a small example of often we want to bring folks to our tables, but what are the tables that are already there that we can join, you know? And a simple way of not expecting Christians from other contexts to use the same app.
You know, sure, how do you,
Mickey, I thought I saw Jonathan looking at me the way a kid looks at a grandparent when he said, "Hey Todd, can you meet," I think it was Bishop Flavio, "Hey, can you meet Bishop on WhatsApp?" And I'm like, "What?
WhatsApp? What's said, that?"
Yeah, what's that? What's WhatsApp?
Oh yeah.
Jonathan said, "I can show you how to put it on your phone." So that's what Jonathan has to deal with his bishop.
Yeah. That is so funny.
I had to learn. I went to Brazil and they were all in Portuguese talk about Zappy. I was
like, oh, yeah.
What is Zappy? Yes. And that's the shorthand for WhatsApp in Brazil.
WhatsApp. Yes.
But yeah, so we have WhatsApp groups, which is a way of just almost every day people are sharing stories and prayer requests. But yeah, we have also weekly prayer times in Spanish. We do noonday prayer on Wednesdays in Spanish. Just a quick 30-minute Zoom. Tuesdays, we have a prayer Zoom for folks that are Nigerian or Pan-African or just interested in partnering with a Nigerian church. But then, yeah, our conference this summer is July 28 and 29 in Austin. And again, the theme is mutuality and mission. And we're hoping folks that are immigrant in our context will come, but also key leaders within C4SO and churches that just want to learn and partner with immigrants.
So thanks for being with us today. We always like to close with a couple of fun stories. So right now, when you think of your work, Jonathan, what author or leader is currently inspiring you?
Yeah, Dr. Sam George is a mentor and continues to be a mentor in the space of diaspora, and is really one of the leading in the world, but in the U.S. in Christian spaces, reading, writing, and talking about diaspora theology. So he's Indian American, and his office is at the Billy Graham Center at Wheaton College, and he works for the Lausanne Diaspora. I think it's called the Global Diaspora Network. And we did an interview with him we have recorded a couple months ago. But he has a book that he has co-authored with, or really edited with, a bunch of folks, called Reflections of Asian Diaspora. So that's a good one to pick up. Within our own family, the ACNA, we have Dr. Danny Carroll Rodas, who is really one of the foremost theologians as well in this space. He wrote Christians at the Border. He has a lot of books. I think it's called Bible Borders and Migration. And so he's spoken at many ACNA events as well. And so those are two men particularly that are reading and writing the space. I think a third woman's voice, which is really key now in terms of thinking a little bit more about global mission, is Mekdis Hadis. She has a book called A Just Mission. She's Ethiopian American and is kind of thinking, what does global mission look like now that all these factors are at play? So those are a couple folks I recommend.
All right, last question, Jonathan. When you look at the immensity of the work, the complexity of the work, what brings you hope? How do you keep hope going in your heart?
Yeah, it's these stories, I think, and particularly when I get to participate in prayer meetings led by immigrant mm-hmm. leaders or global Christians. This, I think, might be a helpful story I can share that ties to the global church, but has been repeated over and over here in the U.S. for me and for so many. Is I was in a season really of burnout. I was in a sabbatical and a transition, and honestly questioning whether I wanted to continue as a priest, and spent 3 weeks in Brazil with Anglicans, Anglican brothers and sisters there. And I was at the church of one of my friends, and I was staying with him and his family. He happens to be a tattoo artist and did one of my tattoos a couple years before that. But he asked me to preach on a Sunday, and I said, "Hey, Brother Eric, I'm burnt out. I don't really have anything to share. I can't preach on Sunday." He said, "No problem." And he preached, and it was a good message on, I think, service, and you know, I think a kind of for the sake of others type sermon. But after he preached, he said, "Jonathan, come up here," and he pulled a chair in front of the congregation, had me sit down, pulled out a basin of water. He brought his stole and in front of the congregation started washing my feet. And one of the things I've been really struggling with, I know many of us in the church these days are struggling with, is issue of power and abuse of power particularly. And he, as he was washing my feet without knowing the situation or my context very well, said in Portuguese, "Jonathan, this is power," and washed my feet with a stole. Wow. And I started weeping like a baby. The congregation started weeping. It was one of those Holy Spirit moments, and my faith was renewed in the vocation of a priest.
Jonathan, beautiful.
Because it was the global church washing my feet. I mean, the unworthiness of that, and just the inverse and power dynamics. And Eric now just was made a bishop. He's an assistant bishop.
Which was awesome, by the way. If people caught like the clip of all the bishops and priests celebrating afterward, it looked like a ton of fun. So they know how to party.
Tattoo artist, now bishop in Brazil.
He's awesome.
But so many of experiences like that I've experienced in the global church around the world, I've experienced in the global church here in the U.S. Sacrificial prayer and miracles and folks that give their lives for the gospel, that sustains me. And it's the hope. It's we find Jesus on the margins, and it refreshes my soul.
Yeah. Well, I want to say on behalf of the Diocese of Churches for the Sake of Others, how grateful I am to have been on this today with you both, Jonathan and Mickey, and the insight and wisdom and love and Christlikeness that you bring to us from your histories are deeply appreciated and valued amongst us. So I feel like today's been a treasure for me. Thanks.
Thanks, Bishop Todd.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thanks so much for tuning in to the C4SO podcast. If you like what you heard, please feel free to share this episode and subscribe and leave a review. It helps us to get the word out. Thanks.